Welcome back to this third episode of the Computing Stories podcast. As always, I have a special guest, and today I talk with Luciano Rizzola. And for the people never heard of you, who are you?
Well, good morning. My name is Luciano Rizzola, and I am a professor of theoretical astrophysics at Goethe University in Frankfurt.
One or two years ago, you took with a large team a photo of a black hole, and I would guess you couldn't just take your normal digital camera, go outside, slap your telephoto lens on it, and then just take the photo. So how can you make a photo of a black hole that's hundreds of light years away?
Yes, actually it's 55 million. Years, light years away. So you're right, you can't just use a normal camera for two reasons. The most important one is that this object, a black hole, is the most compact object we know in the universe. There is nothing you can make more compact than a black hole. Given a certain mass, you cannot put it into a smaller volume than in a black hole. So black holes are intrinsically small. And as I said before, they are also at astronomical distances. They are very large distances. This means that when you have something which is small and you put it at large distance, the way it will appear to you, what we call the projected size on the sky, will be extremely small, of the order of few tens of micro arc seconds. So tens of millionth of a second of arc. Just to give you an idea, the equivalence is like trying to see a coin on the surface of the moon. So it is extremely small size, and you need extremely powerful telescopes. Now, the ability of a telescope to see details, what is otherwise known as resolution, which you can think about, you know, in standard terms, like, you know, how many, what is the size of a pixel in the image. Well, if you want to reach this resolution, you need a telescope which is as large as the whole planet. And this is because if you want to, the resolution is inversely proportional to the size of the telescope. So the larger the telescope, the higher the resolution, more the details you can see. That's what we see when we go from, instance, for, you know, a 50 centimeter telescope to a 1 meter or an 8 meter telescope. We can see much more the details. So if your goal is that of seeing a black hole which has a size on the sky of few tenths of micro arc seconds, the algebra tells you that you need a telescope as large as the whole planet. But of course, we can't build a telescope as big as the whole planet. But what we can do is being smart about it and use a technique which is called interferometry. In particular, it's called very large baseline interferometry, which allows us to essentially do this, to create a virtual telescope which is as large as our planet Earth. And how do we do this? Well, we essentially take telescopes, radio telescopes, and I will explain why it has to be radio telescopes. These are ordinary radio telescopes of the order of 10 meter, maybe 30 meter, nothing very large. And we place them in different positions on the surface of the planet. For instance, one in France, one in Spain, one at the South Pole, one in Chile, one in Mexico, one in Arizona, one in Hawaii. And then it is as if we have produced a telescope which is as large as the separation between the two telescopes, any of the two telescopes. So for instance, if we take a telescope in Arizona and one in Hawaii, and we put them together with this technique, we have a telescope which is virtually large as the distance between Arizona and the Hawaii, which is about 2,500 kilometers. So in this way, we can build a virtual telescope which is as large as the whole planet. You may wonder, how is this possible? Well, in this technique, which is called interferometry, what you're doing is you are making sure of observing exactly the same wavelength, the same wavefront. It's really like you're building a telescope as large as the distance between Arizona and Hawaii, but you are removing all the rest, apart from these two tiny telescopes that are in Arizona and in Hawaii. And then, if that was the case, they would be receiving the same wavefront. And in order to ensure that you are receiving the same wavefront, it is essential that these telescopes have a very precise clock. In fact, an atomic quality clock that measures not only the electric field that is recorded through the radio, but also the time of arrival of the radio wave. And in this way, if you do this, then you can combine the information that you obtain from these two telescopes and put it together into interferometric pattern and learn and have, you know, a virtual measurement, which is that of a telescope of that size.
You talked already about radio telescopes. When you normally think of an telescope, you think of an optical instrument, but a radio telescope isn't exactly optical. So how you can imagine the data coming out of such a telescope?
Right. So first of all, radio waves are, you know, the same waves that we're using right now to talk. That's because I am using my loudspeaker, my headphones and headphones are connected through to my laptop via radio waves. But the reason why we use radio waves, it's actually very important. And it is, light near a black hole is emitted at all wavelengths. You know, there's going to be light in the gamma radiation, in the X-ray radiation, in the optical, in the infrared, and also in the radio, of course. However, not all of this light manages to reach us. And that is because light can be absorbed by whatever is between us and the black hole. And what happens is that essentially radio waves are those that manage to escape all the intermediate material between us and the black hole. And so they can travel from very close to the black hole up to us, and therefore traveling for millions of years, 55 in the case of M87, up to reaching us on Earth. So it's very important that we use radio waves. In particular, we use radio waves that are the most for which, you know, the material is most transparent. And these are radio waves with a wavelength of about 1.3 millimeters. So we're talking about gigahertz here. Only these waves are the ones that we can observe. And of course, as you said correctly, because we're not using light, the image that we produce is not the image that we would see with our eyes, because our eyes are sensitive to the optical. So this is the image that you would see if your eyes were sensitive to the radio. I know it's a bit of a stretch, but an image is just a way of mapping intensity into something else. So what we do is we record the intensity of the radio luminosity and we map it into a color or a brightness. And that's how you can build an image.
After you collected all the data from all the telescopes around the world, you had a lot of images in quotation marks. How you calculated then the famous image you and your team produced of this black hole?
Right, so in the case of the black hole in the galaxy M87, which we dubbed M87 star because we're not sure what to call it. But so that image was built over 7 days of observations. And essentially every day we had to collect data long enough so that we could produce one single image. We observed for about 7 days, but some of the days were not good. The weather was not good. And so we actually observed, we produced observational images just for 4 days, 4 out of the 8 we observed. Now you may ask, what does it mean that the weather was not good? First of all, you need a number of telescopes to build this image. And that is why there isn't just two telescopes, it's a whole network. We used 8 in 2017. And these 8 telescopes, as the Earth rotates, were able to measure and collect data, which was then combined. And now if you, it can happen that the weather in one of these stations, in one of these telescopes is not good. And these telescopes are usually placed in remote areas where the weather is normally good, but it can't be guaranteed to be always good. And it's sufficient that you have some clouds in the sky that would essentially absorb all the radiation. So the radio telescope can observe both in a day and night. There is no problem with that. But the worst enemy is water vapor, so clouds. Standard clouds represent a major problem for radio astronomy, at least at this wavelength. And so what happened is that in some of the sites, not all of them, there wasn't enough, the coverage, the cloud coverage was too large, and so we missed the data from those sites. And when there are too many sites missing, essentially you're not able to reproduce an image. So to recap, we observed for 8 days, we could produce 4 observational images. So this is observation, this is data, this is fact. But then we had to interpret these images. And for that, we had to produce simulate images of what could be producing them. And what we thought is the origin of this image is a black hole that is accreting plasma from its neighborhood. And for these simulations, in these simulations, because we don't know exactly what are the physical conditions near the center of M87, near this black hole, we had to consider many possibilities. And as a result of this, we produced a lot of images, 60,000 images. These images are images that are physically and mathematically consistent in the sense that they respect all the laws of physics and are mathematically the solution of certain equations. But they are not necessarily right because, as I said, we don't know exactly what are the conditions, and you can think that different conditions will lead to different images. So we had 4 observed images and we had 60,000 theoretical images. And we had to then compare these two sets and find which of the theoretical images was closer to the observed one. And once we found them, then we can go back and understand what are the properties. How large is, for instance, the black hole? What temperatures do they have? And so on and so forth. And that's what we've done. So the second part, the more theoretical part, once the images were produced, was to recognizing which one of the theoretical predictions is the correct one.
So the final picture you published, is it a simulation or is it the cone itself, or have you done it with this picture?
No. So that picture we published is the black hole itself. It's the real data. And what we've done is we have used the simulations to explain what that image is and why it looks like it does, why it looks like a donut, you know, with a bright side. And that's what is the result of this comparison. So the comparison was a way to interpret and measure the properties of the black hole on the basis of the observations.
Ah, interesting. So this podcast is called Computing Stories. So what would you say, would this whole black hole photography thing be possible without the computers we have today? So would this be possible, let's say, 30 years ago or something?
Absolutely not. Computers are fundamental for obtaining these results, and in two distinct moments. The first moment is when you collect all the data from the various telescopes and you put it together in this interferometric technique. Now, you have to think that you are collecting data with a receiver which is working at 230 gigahertz. Okay, so every second is producing 230 million, sorry, billion of pieces of information. So the data, the sheer load of the data that is produced, even by just one single observatory, is enormous. We're talking about tens of terabytes. And this data is so voluminous that cannot even be transferred by Ethernet or any internet type of connection. So the only way in which you can actually take this data and bring it over to a computing center is by human intervention. So what we do is we actually send students who are the strongest in our collaboration, and they go to these observatories and come back with their luggage full of hard disks, where all the data is stored. And this data then is collected from all the different telescopes and is brought in a supercomputing center, which is called the correlator. And this computing center, essentially what it does is it takes streams of this data from telescope 1, 2, 3, and 4 and puts them all together so that we have this combination of information. And there is a correlator in US, in Boston, and there is a correlator in Europe, in Germany, in Bonn. And these are very specialized machines that essentially they are just combining strings of binary bits. But the data they handle is so large that when the data arrived in Bonn, all of the hard disks were cast onto a pallet. And the pallet was then moved in a corridor, just a human pushing this pallet. And by doing that, they had reached the largest bandwidth on the planet. So just imagine, by moving so much data, even if it was going at a few meters a second, you had reached the largest bandwidth on the planet. And so this is an interesting story for those who are interested in computing. And this data, sometimes it's very hard to actually get. An example is the data from the South Pole. There is a telescope in the South Pole. The data was taken in April 2017, but we couldn't access the data up until October 2017. And the reason is very simple. Soon after the data was taken, the winter started in the South Pole. And that means no planes could land on the South Pole. And we had to wait for the summer to appear so that people could go, airplanes could land, and the students could go and get the data. So getting the data and combining is a major computing effort. And that's the first part where supercomputers come into play. The second part is producing this simulated data. In order to produce a simulated theoretical image, one needs to solve very complex equations, which are the equations of general relativistic magneto aerodynamics. Essentially, those are the equations that tell you what happens to plasma or to a fluid near a black hole. That's why it is general relativistic. It takes into account space-time curvature. And it's magneto aerodynamics because we expect that it's not just simple aerodynamics, but magnetic fields play an important role. And that's where supercomputing is important, and we need to run our simulations in supercomputers. About half of all of these simulations that were made for those images were actually performed in Frankfurt by my group. So we spent a lot of our time and allocation to compute all of these 60,000 theoretical images that we had then to compare with the observed ones.
How long did this process took for these 60,000 pictures?
So it took about 3/4 of a year, because each simulation takes about between 2 and 3 weeks, and we run something like 400 simulations. So that's roughly how long it took. And of course, this data, once it is produced, needs to be analyzed, checked for correctness, and so on. So it's not just press 400 times a button and get the data. A lot of care needs to be done in order to make sure that the exploration of the space of parameters, of all the possible manifestation in which a black hole and a plasma can appear, were correct.
So we already talked about simulations in connection to black holes. And how would you say, which role plays are simulations playing in physics today?
Okay, that's a good question. I think much of the science we are able to explore nowadays would not be possible without computers. And this is true both at the level of experiments and at the level of theory. The experiments that we are carrying out, just think about, you know, collecting data from astronomical observations or data from particle accelerators like LHC in Geneva. The amount of data we are collecting is so large that even just exploring, just looking at it, requires very, very powerful computers. And the same can be said for the theory. You know, at the beginning of the 20th century, a theoretical physicist could do a lot of these calculations with pen and paper and use very simple models, very simple geometries, highly symmetric configurations, and obtain some sometimes reasonable approximation to nature in this way. But nowadays we're looking at far more complicated problem than, say, a single atom for which you can find an analytic solution. And this means that pen and paper are no longer sufficient in order to simulate such complicated, and we say highly nonlinear, that is, situation where small changes can produce very large variations in the outcome. Well, for this we need supercomputers. And this is particularly true when the mathematical theory behind the phenomenon that one is trying to explain is very, very complicated. And I'm thinking about general relativity, the theory of gravity proposed by Einstein, which is essential in order to reproduce what happens near a black hole, but also other theories like quantum chromodynamics, which is essential to explain what happens when you have two small but very energetic particles that crash into each other.
And you said you are a physicist. How would you, what would you think about the future of simulations in physics? Of course, simulations have the problem, they aren't real, they are just a simulation. So will this become a bigger problem in the future?
Well, I don't see it as a problem at all. I mean, it is a simulation, but it's a simulation that reproduces reality. If you think about weather forecast, okay, do you believe in weather forecast? You're certainly getting better and better weather forecast. And weather forecast doesn't come out of a glass sphere or out of magic. It's the result of simulation that take as starting data the physical condition, temperature, pressure, velocity of the atmosphere at any given position on the planet, use the equations that govern the atmosphere dynamics, and take into account the orography, the way the terrain and the geography of the place influences these motions, and there you have a weather forecast. And nowadays the weather forecast is extremely accurate. So, but it's a simulation, okay? It's a prediction on the basis of mathematical models and the solution of numerical equations. Of course, you know, if you say that that, you know, there is a certain probability that the forecast can be wrong, that's part of the inevitable process of improving the model. But I don't think this is going to be a problem at all. Actually, our simulations will become more and more accurate, just like weather forecasts will become more and more accurate.
What I actually mean by the question, a simulation can't replace an experiment.
And they shouldn't. You know, the experiment is what provides the information about reality. The simulation provides you a way of interpreting that result, of understanding why you get a certain result and not another one, or what that result tells you about the laws of physics. So simulations are not meant to replace experiments. They are always going together with the experiments. Without experiments, the simulations has very little use. You see, theory can produce many different outcomes, okay? But it's just one outcome that is actually the correct one. An example I can give you in this respect is the one about these images we were discussing before, right? There are many possibilities in which you can have that the plasma moves around a black hole. And you can have many different types of black holes. But at the end of the day, there is just one that matches, or a few that matches what we have observed. All the others are plausible, are consistent with the laws of nature and mathematics, but just not being realized in that specific event. So simulations are essential, but they can be used either to make a prediction or to interpret the observations and the experiments, but they will always require the experiments and the observation.
So you say a simulation is more a tool to the physicist than an experiment or something like that.
It is a fundamental. I wouldn't say it's just a tool. It is a fundamental tool in order to understand nature and to make predictions. Sometimes, you know, we make predictions well before the experiment is performed. Again, I'll give you another example. We have recently detected the first gravitational waves from binary black holes or binary neutron stars. But these waveforms were predicted, they were computed by people like me 10 years before they were actually observed. There was a prediction. And through that prediction, people were able to build instruments that were then perfectly tuned to see, to make the observation. So theory can make a prediction, and then the prediction can be confirmed by the experiment. And of course, there are some predictions that the theory make that are not confirmed by the experiment, and these predictions are therefore discarded, although they are plausible.
Computers are getting faster and bigger every 2 years or something. This Moore's law is still working. So where would you see the simulations, especially in correlation to the physicist, in the future? How simulations are developed now and maybe in the future?
But that's also a very good question. Now, you see, the development of the power, of computational power, is increasing year after year. Our ability to make use of this computational power is not increasing equally fast. And this is rather simple to explain. Normally, these simulations are numerical codes that are developed not by computer scientists, they are developed by theoretical physicists or experimental physicists. So people who know the physics more than they know the computer science. And so they are not the most efficient codes possible. They can use the power of supercomputers, but they are not able to match or use all of the power of these supercomputers. So what this means in practice is that our codes need to be rewritten every N years in order to satisfy the constraints that are coming from these very advanced computing infrastructures. And this is a very big effort that is required by the scientific community in order to improve our ability, not only from a mathematical point of view, what I was referring to as the model. So it's not just improving the model, but it's also improving the computer science aspect. I'll give you an example. Most of the codes doing science nowadays are not making use of the computational power offered by GPUs, the graphical processing the interfaces, units, yeah. And, you know, if you compare a GPU with a core, a standard core, you can get easily a factor 10, if not 100, in computational power. But our codes, for a number of reasons, do not make use of or an efficient use of GPUs. And this means that we are not exploiting this facility. And there are many supercomputers that have lots of GPUs that cannot be actually used. And so, in practice, what is needed is, for instance, in our field of generativistic magneto dynamics is to convert codes that work on CPUs so that they can work also on GPUs. And that's, from a computational architectural point of view, a fairly complicated problem.
Nowadays, everybody talks about AIs and stuff like this. Is this also a possibility to simulate things in physics?
I don't think, the simulation per se, but what you can use AI for is to go through large amounts of data and explore this data. So more than making predictions, I think, is when you have many predictions, AI can help you to find which of these predictions is closer to reality. And this is something that we are also exploring. For instance, in the latest image, we produced two images of supermassive black hole. One is at the center of M87, the other one is at the center of our galaxy. The object at the center of our galaxy is called Sagittarius A star. In the case of Sagittarius A star, we had produced almost 6 million images. And you can imagine that the sheer amount of images that are produced every time increases. And so we need more and more powerful tools to be able to distinguish or to compare the observations with the theoretical predictions. And to do this, AI could be a very efficient way of a very powerful way of making this comparison. So the comparison between theory and observation can be helped by AI. I don't think that AI can yet make theoretical predictions.
So I see we already talk about 35 minutes now. So one last question I ask every of my guests, is there anything else, maybe not in exactly in connection to physics, that you would give the listener on their way?
I think if the listeners are interested in computers, but also in astrophysics, and in particular these very bizarre objects like black holes and neutron stars by gravity in particular, I can only recommend those who are interested in these topics to have a look at a book, a popular science book which I have written recently. It can be found in English, it can be found in German under the title, the English title is The Irresistible Attraction of Gravity. The German title is Die unwiderstehliche Anziehung der Schwerkraft, and it's a book which essentially explains why we are attracted by gravity, not just as a physical interaction, but we are attracted in our imagination. Gravity has a grasp on our imagination, attracts our imagination and our thinking. So anyone who is interested in these type of topics can find an introduction to these topics at an elementary and, I hope, understandable way in this book.
And then I would say thanks to you for taking the time to speak in this podcast. I think this episode has become pretty interesting, so thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
No problem.
And thank you to the listeners.
Yes. And for the listeners, I hope you also enjoyed this episode. And in the next episode, I don't know exactly about which topic we will talk then. But until then, goodbye.